It's pretty much every election cycle and often a few times in between, some political figure says we should run government like a business, which is a laudable goal if it is focused on improving efficiencies and not wasting taxpayers' money. But when private for-profit businesses get involved in delivering public services, a mix of goals results. Our guest this hour takes a decidedly dim view of privatizing public goods and services. Donald Cohen is the principal author of The Privatization of Everything, subtitled How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. Donald Cohen is the founder and executive director of the Research and Policy Center in the Public Interest. Alan McCallion, the co-writer of the book, is an author and editor with several titles to his credit. Donald Cohen is our guest. Donald, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you so much. I saw that you are based in the Rogue Valley and Rogue River Valley. I'm a big fan of that area of the country. And then I live in Los Angeles. As I was listening to your weather report, you have a much more diverse weather report than we do down here. But maybe later in the call, we can talk about the privatization of weather.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good point to bring up. Absolutely. Talk about your group in the public interest. Is stopping or reversing privatization its main focus?
Well, that's one of its main focuses. I mean, if you want to go a little bit broader, it's we believe that the public ought to control public goods. And so we advocate for that. And that could include, raising public revenues to provide public things. But we also focus on trying to interrogate private contracts and private public contracts, make sure they're done right when we do contract, but make sure we don't do it when it's the wrong thing to do.
Give an opening sketch, if you would. Have a lot of once public entities ended up privately run or even privately owned?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, the book is called The Privatization of Everything, so it's pretty much everything that we consider public, has private interest involved, whether it's education, whether it's water, roads, bridges, prisons, it's just sort of broad. Let me start by giving a quick story to help people kind of grasp it, if that's okay. An example. Because it seems complicated. It seems like a big thing, sort of too broad to get your hands on sometimes. So the example I like to use is Chicago in the, at the heat of the Great Recession, 2008, 2009, where every city was bleeding red ink, really in deep trouble. So on a Friday, the mayor, Mayor Daley at the time, announced a proposal from a private consortium of Morgan Stanley, a sovereign wealth fund from the Middle East, and a national parking company. And they said they'd give the city $1.1 billion up front in exchange for the city's control of the city's 36,000 parking meters for 75 years. Vote on Tuesday. The city's in desperate straits. They vote without a great deal of scrutiny, without virtually any scrutiny and investigation. After the fact, they discovered two things, one I think more important than the other. One is it's an incredibly stupid way to borrow on your future parking meter revenues because, who knows if we'll be driving. This is until 2083 we're talking about. But even if that was the only choice, they sold $1 billion too cheap. They got taken. But that's not the most important thing. The most important impact here is that now, for the remaining 60-some-odd years of the contract, if they want to eliminate parking spots to deal with climate, create dedicated bus lanes or bike lanes or pedestrian malls, they have to buy the spots back at the future value of the spot. So that essential, which is a lot of money, which is expensive, that ties the hands of the democratically elected city council and mayor to deal with their fundamental municipal responsibilities, land use, housing, transportation, environment. So that's really at the core of this. That it's and every kinds of contract we see, and every privatization of every kind of service and good, we see sort of fundamentally similar things about that. It's a straitjacket on decisions that we should be making.
So let's talk about the basic default thinking though in society was that is the government essentially a last resort if no one can make a profit?
Well, many would say that. I disagree with that. I mean, many say, the government's role is when markets fail. So markets fail in lots of things that we all need. Healthcare. If private entities in the market sell things. That's what they do. They make money. They sell things. They make a profit. That's legit, and it's and we all know it, and we all do it. But you don't sell things to people that don't have money, right? And so why would, you know, that's why there's, you know, still millions of people uninsured. There's still, you know, if you go to broadband, I don't know if you're having that issue in Oregon, but, you know, broadband companies don't, you know, provide broadband to rural areas where the market doesn't exist. So I think about it differently. I think there's private things and there's public things. And the market is simply the wrong tool for public things. Now, that doesn't mean you don't use private companies to do some of it, but to put it in the market means exclusion, means you can't make it available for everybody, regardless of cost for the things like healthcare and other things. So I just think it's, you know, I've said this in some of my writing, it's like using a hammer to cook your eggs. It's just the wrong thing.
So here's where you get to the whole idea of run it like a business. Why is that not an appropriate measure?
Well, because businesses, like I said, businesses do one thing, they sell stuff. And so, and the more they sell, the better, right? Which has got to make sense as well. So prison companies, more heads in beds. That's not in our interest. Oil companies, more gasoline sold. That's not necessarily in our interest at this point. And you can kind of go down the list of things. But they also, you know, they're part of that phrase that I really dislike, because there's good, well-run businesses and there's poorly run businesses. There's well-run governments and there's poorly run governments. What we want is to be run like a good institution with good management and good transparency and visibility. And we need that. And, you know, the private sector takes care of itself, but we need that in the public sector. We need it to be run not like a business. We need it to be run like a really well-managed and run public institution that serves everybody and that is subject to, that thing we call democracy.
The argument that keeping things in private hands keeps government from getting too big, and of course, you know, the more strident form of that is that, well, it's socialism. So where do you take that argument, Donald?
Red herring. So government too big. So take the federal government. The federal, you know, lots of, you know, from 30 years ago to today, the government hasn't gotten smaller. It's gotten contracted out. You know, there are researchers that is, I think Paul Light from New York, found that there are three times as many people who work, who provide public services but work for a private contractor than they are people who work for the public, for the federal government. So it's not that we're making government smaller, number one, okay? We're actually just outsourcing it and losing control over it. So that's the first thing. The other thing, just to the socialism argument, is that we have to decide what we want as a public, right? Do we think everyone should have health care regardless of their ability to pay for it? I personally do. And I could say the same thing about education and some other things. So the only question is then how we do that. Now, if we had like a Canadian-style healthcare system where everybody had healthcare at the same, you know, at the same level, basic level, there'd still be private healthcare providers. It's not socialism. It's not taking over the healthcare facilities and, you know, hiring all the doctors and nurses. That's not the point. The point is the only way to, when you decide something that there's something everyone needs, like clean air, like education, like water, like clean water. The only way you can accomplish that, there's no other way, is through government action. Sometimes it's government provision, sometimes it's government regulation, sometimes it's government, for utilities and other things, but there's no other way to do that. The market simply can't, it's not in place to do that.
So the government has to make some decision in here, and the government, of course, is us, ideally. But there's lots of room in there, it seems like, for the provision of the services then, once we make the decision, how it comes about.
That's exactly right. And everything is public and private. I mean, the roads were built by a private contractor, you know, the roads in front of your house, but it's managed and, you know, by your local city or town. So there's nothing that's not, I mean, electricity, it depends, you know, there are some places that have public electricity, there's some that have private, you know, investor-owned utilities, but those investor-owned utilities are regulated by public, you know, utility commissions and all of that. Our job is to set the standards, right? Everyone should have clean water, everyone should have health care, and then we figure out how to do it at the most efficient, at the most effective, with the greatest control, that we can. Well, one thing you know, it's also worth remembering, when you privatize, you know, when you put something in the private sector, let's say you privatize, you know, a prison, there's money that's being taken from the prison. You know, there's profit. They, you know, their business. They have to. You know, these are two main companies are publicly traded. They have returns to investors. They have very high compensation packages for executives. We've looked at that. They have debt service because they are typically, you know, regularly buying up other companies. You know, doing mergers and acquisitions. So every one of those dollars is a dollar that's not being going to the to provide the service in the prison. Now, whether that's to the you know the workers, the, you know the supplies, the equipment, you know, it's every dollar not being used. Now, because you'll probably ask about efficiency, let me go right to that point as well, because that's the other flip side of this. But they say, you know, private sector is more efficient because you know that's how they justify the greater expenses for profit. When we hear when we hear folks say, well, the private sector is more efficient, we want to ask a very simple question. Because what they're saying is they can do it cheaper. We ask a very simple question. What are you going to spend less money on? It's a quite a finite list of things you could spend less money on. You might be able to come up with a method to do things better, but that's hard in a prison. So you could have fewer workers, and there you know, and they do that. There's a juvenile facility in the South, I think in Mississippi, that went from 1 to 12 corrections officers to inmates to 1 to 60. Bad things happen when you do that. You could pay the workers less; they do that, or you know, with fewer benefits, and you know, you have higher turnover, and other things happen. And so, the only place you can get that money in a service is by less service, and that's what happens.
All right. So, less service certainly increases the margins for the shareholders if it is in fact a privately held company. And then the other thing they're looking for is a larger customer base. But the customers are people incarcerated. So, what has been happening in some states to encourage that number to rise?
Well, the customers. I'm not sure that the customers are the heads of departments of corporations. Mm-hmm. The heads are the governors. The governors. So they're the people that. The main private prison companies, have a very effective advocacy and lobbying program in cities and states around the country, knocking on doors saying we can do this cheaper for you. So what it means for the inmates, you know, they're the I'm not sure what to say. They're the commodity. You know, the heads and beds are what they sell, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the prison companies, every dollar they spend in politics. Every dollar they spend is to grow their business, right? It's to provide the service and grow their business. Again, it's a legitimate business activity. So they spend lobbying money, they spend political money, they spend, you know, they give large contributions into, you know, correctional associations and things like that. Every one of those things are to increase the number of heads and beds. So in the past, you know, they took some heat for this. You know, they were very involved in advocating for strong-on-crime laws. You know, mandatory sentences, three strikes, you're out in California, things like that, as well as minimum requirements in immigrant detention facilities, because the same companies provide those services. So, I say this a lot. Businesses do one thing. They sell things. They want to sell more. They want to spend as little as possible, and they want as big a market share as possible. So everything they do is about that. And I think in prisons, I use the example of prisons because it's so clearly that they have a clear set of interests, but it doesn't align with ours. And that's the problem. When they're using their political, valiance, you know, to expand incarceration at this point, that's a problem for us. That needs to be a decision of public policymakers about it. What should we do about the criminal justice system? And personally, I think less heads and beds is where we ought to be heading.
Donald Cohen's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the principal author of The Privatization of Everything, How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. I want to get a little discussion here anyway about private contractors in the military. How extensive has that area become?
Yeah, George W. Bush, made that, sort of supercharged that. So I don't have numbers in my fingertips, but it's massive and significant. We've been doing two things about our wars in the last 30 years. One is we don't pay for them anymore. You know, we don't ask the American people to pay for them anymore. We used to do that. And then we contract lots of things, not just food services and, the commissary and things like that. It's actually, fighting, frontline services. And there's a few impacts of that. What I said about the not paying for war is that, I don't support all wars. I think, you know, World War II was a legitimate war. People have different opinions about wars, but once we decide to do it, it needs to be an all-in project, right? That's what how democracy works. So when we pay for wars on debt, or when we contract out stuff, and we're not asking of sacrifice, you know, we're not asking all the rest of us to sacrifice. It's, you know, it's a lot easier to wage war when we're not paying attention. We don't feel the sacrifice like my parents did in World War II. Mm-hmm. That had to save tin when they were at home, and went to war, you know, like my father did.
So, in addition to, let's move into schools now, because a little change in wording goes a long way, and we got people who refer to them not as public schools but government schools. Who started to popularize that terminology?
You know, very conservative forces who, you know, want to dismantle government. You know, I think people like Milton Friedman, Trump said it. You know, we saw the rise of that over the last few years, and let's just say where that's coming from. So. Who drives privatization? You know, there's a few folks. One is there are people ideological, you know, who really don't believe that the government should provide things. Let me see. You know, I have to find here. So I have a quote by Milton Friedman. Okay, by Milton Friedman, economist, conservative economist, mm-hmm. in the 50s, who came up with the idea of school vouchers. And here's what he said, not in the 50s, more recently. He said, in my ideal world, government would not be responsible for providing education any more than it is for providing food and clothing. So he believes education should be a public service. You know, we should all just go in the market. So there's the true believers. Then there's the money. There's lots and lots of money to be made, and that's true in private, you know, in education as well. Massively true in education. We spend nearly, you know, upwards towards $1 trillion a year in education in this country. And the third are sort of politicians and sort of the political class that want to, you know, downsize government, weaken public employee unions, I mean, particularly education unions. So it's all coming from that. So the idea that government schools is just simply a trope to say, look, the government, you know, people already distrust the government. Here's another reason for you to dislike a fundamental, you know, public service and public good, fundamental to our democracy, to our economy, to all of the above.
Milton Friedman, I'm glad you mentioned it, because he does take quite a whooping in your book.
Yeah, well, he's a true believer. He came up with the idea of vouchers. I mean, I think the other thing to talk about, everything we talk about in the book, is that the school choice movement, because, again, they're good at language, right? The school choice movement, who could be against choice, the roots of that were a segregationist response to Brown versus Board of Education. That's what it was called back then, the school choice movement. That, you know, and what states did was pass voucher laws so that you could take your tax dollars and go and make sure that your kid wasn't in a school with a black child. So that's, you know, that's where this all started, and that continues to present day, right? So mm-hmm. there's, you know, there for all these different motivations, from the Milton Friedman ideological motivation to the anti-teachers union motivation to kind of all of the above, we are seeing increasing segregation again, because of the growth of voucher initiatives, you know, voucher laws, and the growth of charter schools around the country. Now, charter schools are very controversial. There's good ones and there's bad ones, but it's it's a publicly financed, privately operated school. There's lots of private interest, you know, for-profit interest in it, as well as non-for-profit interest in it. But it's, you know, I could give examples, but what's starting to happen is, you know, increasing segregation, increasing stratification, which is exactly what happens in the market. And it's the market model.
Donald Cohen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the founder and executive director of the Research and Policy Center in the Public Interest. He is the principal author with Alan McAlean of The Privatization of Everything, subtitled How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. This is a conversation you're more than welcome to join and may have quite a few feelings about. So come join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And anybody thinking, well, I don't have any loved ones in prison, I don't have kids in school. Ah, but then we get to part two of the book and we get into health and water and food safety. So all kinds of realms in here where public services that can be privatized touch our lives. Public water gets us into stories of Nestle and protests against its practices. Remind us of some of those, Donald.
Well, you know, we all unfortunately drink bottled water now for all sorts of reasons, convenience and, you know, worries about the quality of our water. And so, you know, Nestle's is, you know, a global company that is, has all the, you know, there's lots of different deals, but Florida, Michigan, and California has states where they're able to, you know, extract water, you know, water from, you know, springs or rivers, bottle it up and sell it to us. And again, I don't remember the specifics of some of these deals, but they're sweetheart deals. And, you know, it's nothing more ours as a public than nature, right? But they've figured out how to use their economic power and perhaps their political power to to figure out how to extract those resources for, you know, for sales and profit. You know, look at the outcomes. The outcomes are water systems around the country that are, you know, that need a great deal of, you know, lots of people don't have clean water. Look at the amount of plastic we're dealing with right now in the oceans and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, Nestle's can sell. I occasionally will buy a bottle of water. I try not to now, but again, it's their interests are different. That's what I keep going back to. They're taking our stuff. They're turning it into something, a commodity. You know, they're turning spring water into a commodity and selling it to us. There's got to be a better way.
So there are lots of examples in here. Missoula, Montana is a big one in the book, and the private waterworks there. How big a fight was there in Missoula to reclaim as a public thing?
Oh, it took a number of years. So Missoula did a, you know, it's a little bit of a complicated deal in terms of a few different companies, but they basically, you know, handed their water off to a private company, the Carlisle. They thought they didn't realize what they were getting into, which I'll bookmark right there, because it's often that we don't think, you know, policymakers don't think forward about the impacts and don't ask the hard questions that gets us into trouble, like in the Chicago parking meters. So they thought they would easily be able to get out of the deal and buy it back, and it turned out that wasn't true. They wanted to buy their water back. They offered a price. The company said, sorry, it's worth a lot more, and back and forth in the courts for several years, for ultimately they got it back at a price that was far too much. Far too much, but, you know, the company, you know, they negotiated in their interest. They wanted to get as much as possible. And one of the interesting things that sort of in that story is, you know, people were not massively unhappy with the delivery of their water system. You know, it was fine. It's Missoula, Montana. But they didn't really think it should be a public good that they should have control over. Right. And that was a lot of the motivation. They thought it's theirs, we want it, it's ours, it should, you know, this money should not be leaving the community, it should be staying here, and we should be able to do it. You know, it's something that basic to our survival and our community that there's no reason for someone else to be able to call the shots.
So you move into transportation and communication, and we get the story of how railroads were built in the 19th century, and it gets us into land grants to the railroads, which obviously is a huge factor still in land management and local revenue in the West. I mean, in your opinion, was there a better way to entice railroads to build?
That's a very good question. I'd have to think about that. Well, is there a better way? There's always a better way, because here's why. I mean, if we're spending the money, we can determine the terms, right? It's often that we spend the money on something, but we don't, you know, because, you know, they're private industry, they think that, you know, they'll say that's not your role to tell us how to do things, but it's our money. I mean, whether it's money or it's a land grant, it's our asset. So we absolutely could have done it better. Now, I'd have to go back and really think about what would be the specific alternative, but, you know, Iowa lost its ability to create a hub system, because it was purely driven by market concerns to get stuff to the East Coast. Now, it's not an illegitimate thing we'd want, you know, folks would want to do, but it did constrain Iowa to be a farming state, because it was just, you know, it's all just all East-West lines, not North-South lines. Those are public decisions, and, you know, something I tell every public official I talk to is that your job is to negotiate on the public's behalf. And often we don't do that.
Interesting email here from Rebecca in rural Lane County. Donald, she writes, in principle, I agree with you. It just seems like public ownership and management is so complicated and difficult now that we can't seem to get much done without endless wrangling.
Well, that's a good point. So, you know, I'd say a couple things that to that. If, whether we do it privately or do it publicly, if it's a public thing, a public good, the public has to be involved. If we're going to contract for something, we don't just give it away and turn away. We have to manage it. And that's actually harder to do. When you contract out something, it's harder because you're taking the, you know, the distance between the, you know, the person who wants this thing and the person who's doing the work is now more further away. It's more bureaucratic. So we can never outsource our responsibility to make sure it's done well. So that's number one. The other thing is people should remember that it's not all bad. There are things all around us that are, you know, that are done well. There are people work going to work every day for local governments, for state governments, for even for the federal government. Scientists who helped develop the vaccine, sanitation drivers who picked up my trash this morning, that are sort of doing okay. The news, you know, the daily news, and you know, is a bath of bad news, is a shower of bad news every day. But there are public things all around us that we take for granted that aren't all failing. We just don't see them. We're not aware of them. You know, one thing I say about the public services around us is that they're both ubiquitous and invisible at the same time.
Oh, in the sense that we use them all the time, but we take them so much for granted that we don't even really notice them.
Yeah, you turn on the faucet, the water comes out. It's kind of a miracle. You flush the toilet. The paint on our walls used to have lead in it, and it doesn't because of government. You know, civic engagement, you know, people, you know, advocated, and the government passed a law to prevent it. Our paint's healthier now. It's literally, you can look around your room and you will see all sorts of, think about all sorts of examples of the public in your life.
So it's at this point in the book that you get to what you call P3, the public-private partnership, which is heralded as this great combination of the best of both worlds, but you don't see it as beneficial all around.
No, well, it's not been. I mean, again, it's this issue of control, right? So, you know, the Chicago parking meter deal was a P3, was a public-private partnership. And so they want to make money. You know, so let's take a road, right? You know, we want to build a road, and it's a P3, a public-private partnership. The private company wants to make money. So in the fine print of, you know, in the contract, you know, the contracts are very rigid documents. They are protecting their interests. In Chicago, it was, you got to buy the spots back. In roads, it is often what are referred to as non-compete clauses or compensation clauses, where the city or the state or jurisdiction is limited or even prohibited from upgrading or building competing, mass transit or roads that you wouldn't have to pay a toll on.
Yeah, that one really kind of made my eyebrows go up, that a toll road operator in Indiana was prevented the improvement of parallel roads.
That's exactly right. And so these are common features. I mean, Chicago deal was horrible. Indiana was, we would think it was a horrible deal, but they decided to go forth anyway under the Pence administration. You know, again, I always think, like, it's in there, you know, here's what the business side says. Here we have a deal. It's a 50-year deal. You change the rules, compensate us, right? Or we'll prevent you from being able to change the rules. In, you know, outside of Denver, then it was a 99-year deal, longer than they do now. They are prevented from upgrading the roads that people would, if people wanted to take an alternative route to avoid the tolls. That's what I mean when I say at the core of all this is it's the straitjacket on democracy.
All right, so this, let's go from roads to talk about public transit, which you advocate making free, and it is in several places. Corvallis, Oregon, no charge for the buses. How easy or hard a sell has this been in places where it is free?
Well, apparently not. You know, Kansas City did it. You know, there's a sort of a growing list. I mean, even I saw something in San Diego. Right? You know, I used to live in San Diego, generally a conservative place, is looking at the possibility of making their light rail free. So here's something to think about. We decide how we're going to pay for things, right? Transit, you know, road, buses, light rail, subways. We say that's a commodity. You're going to pay by the use, right? Okay. Now we don't do that in the road to go to the grocery store. So there are things we decide that just are available to everybody, right? And you don't have to pay a toll to, you know, to leave your driveway if you live in a home. So we could decide to do that for transportation, you know, for that kind of transit, and the benefits, if you're really thinking comprehensively about how we pay for things and the benefits we get. So we want to get people out of our cars for climate. You know, I live in L.A. for traffic. You know, we want to get people out of our cars. If you make the, if you eliminate the fares, you will do that, right? And that, and so, why not just pay instead of turning it, you know, making it a commodity, paying as a commodity, pay it as a public good? Because in the end, there's only one place the money does come from, and that's us.
Yeah,
right.
That's right.
And here's the other thing: it's not just about in transit. You know, transit and roads are about something larger, about mobility. We need to be able to move around as a society. Businesses, cargo, you know, going to school, all of the above. So we need everybody to be able to move around. Let's say. So that's the public good, mobility, in my view. So it's in my interest for more people to use the light rail, even if I don't.
Let's switch from light rail to heavy rail for just a moment, though, because here's a case that can be used to bludgeon the people who are against privatization, which is California's high-speed rail system. It's over budget, under length, and behind schedule, and it's primarily a public thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it would be a public service. I mean, you know, I followed that for quite some time. I knew that one of the people who was advocating for it way back when. You know. Yes, and it was democratically decided. So what the, you know, we'll see whether, you know, what ends up in the end. I mean, there's no real high-speed rail in the United States. I've been on high-speed rail in Spain, I think it was. There's other countries that are doing it quite well, and it's a value, right? There's clearly value in that. The question is the decision. Did we think forward enough, right? That's a key decision, whether it's public or private. The second is, you know, it's being built privately. It's a public decision. And what controls do we have to keep it on track? So just because we decide something doesn't mean we get to walk away and say it doesn't matter how we do it. I mean, the planning, the implementation, you know, it did get, you know, the unfortunate thing for public goods is it becomes a political hot potato, right, in the sense that those people that, you know, those that don't want to provide, you know, subsidized or public rail, you know, we're able to, you know, throw some wrenches in it a little bit. So it's got to be good.
We have an email here from Heidi Notown given, Heidi in Medford, who writes, we have gone to war in other countries so our oil companies could make money on their oil. 1953 in Iran, our CIA and Great Britain removed Mohammad Mossadegh and put in the Shah again because they wanted to keep their oil for their own profit. Result, 1979 uprising. So there's another example from Heidi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, exactly. Again, I've said this, you know, I keep repeating this because it's, I don't blame businesses for doing what they do because that's what they do. That's all the oil companies do is sell oil. And then the only question is, what do they do? How do they use their power to, you know, to charge or supercharge those sales? And is it in our interest? And that's, you know, and just because I say something should be decided democratically doesn't mean that we get what we want. You got to fight for, you know, you got to fight to make sure democracy lives up to the, you know, to our founding principles. Clearly, we're having a struggle with that right now.
Indeed, let's take a phone call here from Andy in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Donald Cohen, the author of The Privatization of Everything.
Yeah, good morning. I'm one of those people that, to me, the 10 most terrifying words are, "I'm from the private sector and I'm here to help." I'm wondering if your guest can give us any idea about what we can do politically to stop this this avalanche of privatization.
All right, thanks for that, Andy. And that's a big question, Donald. I mean, there's a, you know, the whole idea that the market can handle so much is still a very strong and appealing pitch in our society.
That's right. So I'd say a couple things. It's a great question, Andy. So a couple things. One is we have to sort of take on those beliefs because those beliefs are, to a great extent, manufactured. I mean, there's been a 40-year effort to advocate and, you know, popularize those ideas. It's a propaganda victory in many ways. You know, the business is more efficient, right? The government is inefficient. So all those things that have come kind of, you know, they're in the air right now. They're not all true. Like I said, markets are, there's market things and there's public things. There's, you know, there's efficiency. Efficiency, if that means cutting services, that's not really what we want. So number one is we have to begin to push back, and what I say is interrogate those phrases, not just assume them in all cases. And second, I think what we need to do politically is make sure, you know, the world's a complicated place. Government's a complicated place. So is the private sector. We make sure that we set standards for every public decision we make and every public power we have. Governments in the, across the country spend $2 trillion on contracts. We have a lot of power there to set the terms. Local governments have land use power, and you can kind of, so every decision should be at least do no harm to the big ones, inequality, climate, democracy, racism, but better yet, actually, you know, move the ball forward. That's the first thing, and then the second thing is make sure we have cops on the beats that those standards are lived up to, and that's at every level of government.
Which gets into a major issue with transparency, which you find some issue with in privatization.
Yeah, when things go private, they go dark. I mean, it's again, it's, you know, that's the other thing, but you know, as a difference between public, you know, private things and public things. Private, the market, key thing in the market is to keep things secret. You don't want to share your secret sauce, your trade secrets, right? And so, and there's lots of examples where, you know, people file, you know, records requests or Freedom of Information Act requests, get a contract which is entirely redacted out. I mean, a number of examples of that. Charter schools is an example I mentioned earlier. The original idea of charter schools was, you know, create laboratories of innovation, spread the ideas throughout the education system so all could benefit. Great idea. It's become different, it's become a market good. So many charter schools around the country require their teachers to sign NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, to prevent them prohibit them from sharing the school's, quote, trade secrets. What are those trade secrets? Lesson plans, curriculum, teaching methods. The exact things that both, one, we're paying for, and two, if we really want to have every child educated, need to be shared broadly.
So you're talking about the ways in which we can take on the system, and one of them is to make the case in a public forum, and wow, I had not heard of crowds on demand. That was an interesting sidelight.
Yeah, well, you know, it's AstroTurf. It's often referred to. You know, when, you know, in local government, local governments, you know, you go to city council meetings, and you know, you fill up the chambers, and your side argues, and their side does their testimony. But you know, companies, you know, want to get something done. They have resources. Remember where they get those resources from? Us, one way or the other. So they hire people. You know, they have companies that offer the services to hire people to fill up the seats. In the city council chamber, say, you know, they get there early, so they get the front seats. I imagine they all wear the same T-shirts saying no on Proposition X or yes, whatever they're advocating for. You know, they've made politics a sport rather than a civic discourse.
So we're down to our last minute here, Donald, and I just want to ask about, one of the six steps you list in how to correct things is to pay for the things we value. There's some sticker shock there. How do you overcome that?
Well, first is to remember that things cost money, right? If we value them, we need to pay for them. That's number one. Number two is to realize that we pay for what we have, we pay anyway, right? It's super important, whether it's a fare or a fee, or a tax, we pay anyway. The third is to realize that it matters how we pay in terms of, you know, how we share the tax burden progressively and when we pay. If we pay late, we pay more. If we pay early, we prevent, we pay less.
All right, so really hold the government's feet to the fire, particularly in cases like Chicago where they sold their parking meter income for $1 billion for, what was it, 85 years?
75 years.
Wow, that's an amazing story. A lot of more amazing stories in the book as well. The Privatization of Everything, How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America, and How We Can Fight Back by Donald Cohen and Alan McCallion. Donald, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Well, thanks so much. I look forward to getting up to Oregon sometime soon.
We'll look forward to having you here. Take it easy.